You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to archpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to archpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's archpodnet.com/members.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 23. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we talk to Tom King, the senior archaeologist on the Tiger Project, the team that's looking for Amelia Earhart. We talk about the expedition they just wrapped up this year and about what they learned.
Let's dig a little deeper. All right, welcome back to the Archaeology Show. And as we said in the introduction, we've got Dr. Tom King. Dr. Tom King is a well-known scholar and professional in the world of historic preservation and has written numerous books on preservation and heritage laws that are taught in college programs around the United States. We're talking to him today, however, about his work with the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery and their search for Amelia Earhart. They had a recent expedition that just finished up not too long ago. They recently completed, as I said, their summer trip to, and you'll have to correct my pronunciation on this, but Nikumaroro Island, and we're going to talk about what they learned. So welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you. You pronounced that very well.
Thank you. And the acronym for the group, is it TIGAR is how you pronounce it?
We call it TIGAR, like go get them.
TIGAR, okay.
Yeah.
Nice, nice. All right. And we'll have in the show notes, too, I was just mentioning to Tom in the before we started recording that this is the third time, from what I can tell, that he's been on the Archaeology Podcast Network. He's been on the CRM Archaeology Podcast on episode 4, like almost over 4 years ago, and episode 99, which we just recorded back in, I think, November or December. So check those out if you want to hear more Tom King. He's in the, those links are in the show notes. But Tom, let's start kind of at the beginning for people who might not be aware of TIGAR and the organization. What is TIGAR? You know, what primarily do they do? It's, I mean, the acronym would suggest you don't just search for Amelia Earhart, unless that's the biggest thing going on with TIGAR right now.
It's probably the biggest thing going on right now. But TIGAR was initially formed as a preservation organization to basically promote the preservation of historic aircraft and the recovery of historic aircraft that are lost someplace. So the Amelia Earhart study came along, and initially TIGAR wasn't much interested in it because there are so many crazy theories about what happened to Earhart that it just didn't seem worth following up. But eventually a couple of members came up with a hypothesis that made sense and that could be pursued and could be tested, and TIGAR got involved in trying to test it. And we've been at it for almost 30 years. So no, it's not the only thing that TIGAR does by any means, but it is a big thing that TIGAR does.
Okay, great. And how long have you been senior archaeologist for TIGAR?
Oh, I think I dropped that title on about 25 years ago.
Nice, nice. All right. Well, let's get into some questions about the most recent expedition. So I think you guys, in the preliminary report you sent me, are calling this the ninth expedition out to Nikumaroro Island?
Well, yeah, there's a problem with that. It's actually about the 11th or 12th, but
okay.
The numbering system has gotten screwed up, as numbering systems tend to get. so it's about the, I think it's actually the 11th trip, but it's called NIG9, and don't ask me to explain that. It's silly, but anyway, that's what we call it. So the next one, if there is one, will be NIG10.
Okay. Like artifact numbers on a big project, they never stay straight, do they?
Yeah.
So why don't you start by giving us, I guess, a brief synopsis of the highlights of what you guys knew based on previous expeditions up to the point of the start of this most recent one? Like, what did you go back to Nicomororo Island this summer? What knowledge did you go there with from previous expeditions?
Well, first, it's not from previous expeditions, but from basic research. We know that, Earhart and her navigator, Fred Newton, in their Lockheed Electric Penny, disappeared on July 2nd, 1937, somewhere in the vicinity of Howland Island, which is about 350 miles north of Nicomororo. They were trying to fly around the world at the equator, which was a big deal at the time, and they couldn't find Howland Island. The Coast Guard cutter that was lying off the island trying to guide them in couldn't reach them, couldn't establish two-way radio communication, couldn't guide them in. They disappeared. There was a major search laid on. They couldn't be found. So eventually the Navy gave it up and said, they're lost. We think that they flew down what's called the line of position, a line that they had plotted that basically ran through Howland Island perpendicular to their route of flight, and that would take Nicomororo. We think they landed on Nicomororo safely. And there were like over 100 radio signals received after the disappearance, many of which appeared from radio direction finding to have emanated from the vicinity of Nicomororo. The Navy, however, flew over the island, didn't see anybody, and never landed, never checked, never went back. So there was that to begin with. Then in 1940, the island was uninhabited in 1937, and it's uninhabited today. But in 1939, a colony was established there as part of the British Crown Colony of the Gilbert and Ellis Islands. And there were about 10 guys put ashore to clear vegetation and begin planting coconuts. In 1940, by the time they had their families there and they were setting up a village and beginning to really clear the land, they found some human bones. They found 13 bones of a human skeleton down toward the southeast end of the island. They thought it might be Earhart. They sent it to Fiji, to the headquarters of the Western Pacific High Commission, Fiji, where the bones were examined by a medical doctor who said, I think it's either half-breed or full-blood European male. Luckily, he wrote down his measurements, the measurements that he took. The bones disappeared. We have the measurements, and they were examined by modern forensic anthropologists who thought they were most similar to a European female of about Earhart's height. Now, that's been challenged by a couple of physical anthropologists in Australia, and our physical anthropologist is writing in a rebuttal that now is in peer review. And so the beat goes on all that. So we went to the island in 1989, and we've done a variety of things there over the years. But suffice to say that we found a site on the southeast end of the island that we were before this expedition pretty sure was where the bones had been found in 1940. And at that site, we found a number of interesting artifacts and features. We've done really now four seasons of archaeological work there. I should back up and say that in 1940, there were some interesting artifacts found with the bones, including a sextant box that it has also been lost. Mm. But from the information we have on it, it very much appears to have been a U.S. Navy surplus sextant box from World War I. Anyway, we have found a number of interesting features there, fire features, where somebody had been camping and they had been processing fish in ways that were not the way local people process fish. They were, for example, throwing away the heads rather than consuming the heads. they were processing shellfish in ways that were unlike the way that local people process shellfish, breaking them up rather than allowing them to get warm and open. And there were a number of interesting artifacts, like what appears to be the remains of a woman's compact that is the same size and shape as one we have photographs of in Earhart's hands on the world flight, and a jar that contained a mercury-based substance, almost new freckle cream. We'd found all that kind of stuff, and we've had preliminary reports out on all that. This year, with the support of the National Geographic Society, we took forensic dogs to the site to see if they could detect exactly where the bones had been found in 1940 and give us some specific sites to excavate where we might be able to find bones that could be subjected to DNA analysis. So that's sort of where we stood when we left the U.S. in late June.
Interesting. Can you explain to our readers how, or our listeners, how forensic dogs could find bones or where human remains had been, you know, from an event that happened 70 years ago?
It seems like 80 years ago. Well, that's a real interesting question, and it's one to which there is not a very clear answer. There is something about human decomposition products, and it's not just bones, but the products of a human body's decomposition into the soil. And that includes bones, but can be more than bones. I mean, there's obviously a lot of stuff that seeps into the soil as a body decomposes. And that stuff lasts for quite a while. These dogs have been able to detect prehistoric burials in Southern California and elsewhere. A lot of forensic dogs have been used on World War II era remains around the Pacific and in Europe. So it's not known exactly what it is that they're sensing, and there's a good deal of research going into that, which we hope we can contribute to. But they sense it. They can sense where a human body has decomposed.
Do the canine forensics people have a time frame they've tested that to? Like, how far back a dog can smell? I'm sure there's tons of factors, environmental factors, you know, decomposition factors and things like that. But it's just amazing to me, 80 years, like you said, and with the gentleman in the 40s or 1940 removed the bones, and there's probably been rains. I mean, it's a tropical island, so there's rains, all kinds of stuff that's happened there since then. But those dogs are still smelling, you know, and pointing on the right location. And I noticed in your report that there was another, I think, prehistoric cemetery found, and that was kind of like a good control for them, really, probably, that they were finding obvious burials, you know, like that. So, you know, they were looking at the right spot. But just to briefly talk about that, do you know how far back they have tested, like, canine forensic dogs as far as being able to sense that?
Well, they've done a good deal of work with the Donner Party.
Okay.
So that's, what, 100 and something years old.
Yeah, yeah.
They've done some work with prehistoric sites in Southern California and in the Southwest, I believe. Exactly how far back they can go, we don't know. And again, it's a very, it's an area of research that, could use more research. and hopefully we'll stimulate some interest in conducting controlled experiments.
Right. Okay. So I want to go back real quick to something you mentioned when you were given the synopsis of kind of what happened with Amelia Earhart, or what we think happened. You mentioned, I think somewhat casually, that you think some researchers think the plane landed safely on that island. That's a hypothesis anyway, which that actually surprises me quite a bit, because even if the plane were, decomposed or cannibalized or something, you know, even by people living on the island, if it were taken apart, you'd think that some bit of the plane would remain. That wasn't a tiny plane. It wasn't a massive plane, but it wasn't a real small plane either. And if it landed safely, that would be quite the shock to me that nothing remains. I mean, I did work on a Southern California naval base last year, and there's planes that they've utterly purposely destroyed with various types of ammunition. And those planes are 60, 70 years old. And I mean, they're just not going away. There's just still pieces of them out there. Now, I understand it's the California desert and not a very, you know, corrosive environment like a tropical island. I get that. But is there any hypothesis on what could have happened to the plane if you think it landed safely?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have a pretty definite idea of what happened to the plane.
Okay.
The place we think they landed, and there's a variety of pieces of evidence that point to this location, is a stretch of reef flat, that is the flat area of reef between the land and where the reef drops off into the abyss, which was, the tide was low at the time they would have arrived there. In fact, it was a dead low neap tide. So the reef flat was virtually dry. And there is this great, huge, smooth area as big as a substantial runway on which one can land. We think they landed there. Over the next several days, the tide got steadily higher. The high tides got steadily higher because you've got the tidal cycle goes from the neap tide, which is the lowest of the low, to the flood tide, which is the highest of the high. And we think that over the next several days, during which time they got radio messages off, which they could not have gotten out if the plane had been in the water,
right,
or if the plane had been wrecked. The plane had to be standing on its wheels. They had to be able to crank a prop, run the generator, operate the radio. We think they got all the radio messages off, and then the tide floated the plane off the edge of the reef into the very high energy environment along the edge of the reef, where it was just broken up into little bitty bits. Pieces did, we think, get washed ashore. And we have pieces of airplane in the colonial village that was established on the island in 1938 and lasted till 1963. That may have come from Earhart's plane. They could have come from other airplanes too, but they are pieces of aircraft aluminum that people had scavenged mm-hmm. someplace. So, we think that it was on the reef, it went off the reef, it got broken up. We debate over whether there's very much left on off the edge of the reef. A lot of money has been invested in looking for the airplane in the deep water off the reef. I am frankly not enthusiastic about that operation, but others in the organization are, and the search goes on for the plane.
Okay. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take our first break. I would just remind everybody as we go into this, first break, to check out the arcpodnet.com/shop and get your stickers for the Archaeology Show, for the Archaeology Podcast Network, and all most of the remaining shows on the network right now. And we've got some other stuff coming soon. By the time this podcast comes out, I think we'll even have coffee mugs up there and maybe t-shirts. So get those, and we'll be back in just a minute after the other side of the break.
Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/ARC365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Okay, we're back. And when we left at the end of the last segment, we were talking about the aircraft and how you guys think it probably broke off, was carried off the side of the reef and then broken up into pieces. I'm curious about that real quick. You know, you said a lot of money and research has been put into finding that plane. I know that in other similar, I guess similar environments as far as salt water in the ocean goes, they have found aircraft and ships and things like that, you know, deep below the ocean in, you know, not super horrible preservation, but definitely have found it. Of course, they're all rusted and corroded and things like that. But what kind of research has been done, do you know, on that, on searching for the plane? Any sort of, you know, non-destructive techniques, like I don't know what they use for that kind of stuff. There's underwater metal detectors. I know that.
Well,
do you know what's been used?
Oh, yeah. We started out in 1989, when we first went out there, we had divers who went down to diver depth, about 100 feet,
mm-hmm.
all the way around the island with metal detectors, and found essentially zip. But they also found that the reef drops off very, very steeply. And what it does is it drops off very steeply for about 50 meters, then it levels out a little bit, and then it drops off about 1,000 meters. And then it levels out a bit, and then it drops off 7,000 meters.
Jeez.
So that's the problem. And, you know, what you're talking about is a reef on the top of an old volcano. So you're talking about this huge mountainside on which this little plane broken up into little pieces can scatter itself. And that's probably what happened. Again, we have arguments about to what extent the plane may have gone down intact. Those who were airplane people in Tiger, and I am not an airplane people. I don't know a thing about airplanes except they got wings and tails and jets
right.
and stuff. The people who are airplane people would love to find that airplane in semi-intact form. And they've looked for it to some extent. The trouble is that it's a great big, huge mountainside underwater, and you can't search it. You can't just swim down and look at it. It takes remotely operated vehicles. It takes manned submersibles. It costs a lot of money. And that's the big problem. It costs a hell of a lot of money. In 2012, there was an expedition, a Tiger expedition, that they spent about $2 million down there trying to find the thing on the reef. And they found some interesting evidence, but nothing that really fit. We've done side scan sonar. We've done we've plotted the topography of the mountainside down to about, I don't know, a couple thousand meters. We've gotten a lot of data, but we've not found the plane.
Okay. Well, so let's move on from that. Another comment you made that you have evidence that somebody was there. You mentioned the fish and that, you know, not eating it like the locals do, throwing the heads away rather than eating them, things like that. Has there been historical research done on the area regarding other possible explanations, like, for example, other ships that may have gone down in the area at the right time that could have caused a castaway to be there? I know some other person is always, you know, until you find clinching evidence that it's Amelia Earhart or Fred Noonan, for that matter, also there, then, you know, it could be somebody else. So,
sure.
You know, what research has been done to maybe look at other accounts of lost ships in the area?
Well, we've looked for accounts of lost ships, and the only ship that is recorded to have been lost, now, of course, you know, well, there's recorded and then there's lost.
There
might have been unrecorded ships, but in terms of recorded shipwrecks, there's only one. In 1929, the SS Norwich City went up on the northern reef right near where we think Earhart probably landed, and it was a big steel-hulled freighter. Hit the island full tilt. They didn't know the island was there, and they were in a storm, and they ran into it full blast. The ship blew up, burned. 11 men were lost. Five bodies were recovered. The others were not. Presumably, they were eaten by the sharks. Now, could one of them have somehow swum from the northwest or floated or drifted or something from the northwest reef to the southeast reef and wound up at the site where we think Amelia died? Well, yeah, that's possible. And they could have been clutching their sextant box, though the dating on the sextant box doesn't work very well. It's not impossible. So there's that possibility. What's more complicating is first that the island was colonized in 1939, and that colony lasted until 1963. And in 1963, the residents were evacuated, and most of them wound up in the Solomon Islands. We've been to the Solomon Islands. We've interviewed people there who had lived on Nikumaroro. And they say, oh, yeah, we used to go down to that site to catch turtles and birds. And we would sometimes camp out when we were kids. It was something kids would do. They'd go down and have campfires and so on. Now, in the major excavations that we've done, we've basically been able to discriminate between two different kinds of campfire. There are little bitty campfire features, and then there are great big campfire features. And the big ones seem to have been there for quite a while. They represent somebody who was there for a period of time. The little ones look like overnight operations. So we think the little ones are from the kids who were camping there in the late 40s and 50s, and the big ones probably are not, but they could be, except they have these weird artifacts in them. But there's the other complication. Not only were there European, Australian, British, and some American artifacts coming into the colony between 1939 and 1963, but there was a U.S. Coast Guard LORAN station, long-range navigation station, on the southeast end of the island about half a kilometer southeast of our site from 1944 to 1946. And we know that people from the Coast Guard station used to go up to the site, what we call the Seven site, where we think Earhart died. And they did things like they shot birds. They took their M1 carbines and shot birds. The site is covered with M1 carbine cartridges. This year we found a ball, a rubber ball, and thought, what the hell is that? And somebody said, well, maybe they had a dog. And of course they did have a dog. They had a couple of dogs at the Coast Guard station. So, you know, there is a lot of potential for confusion of the site by subsequent or previous occupation. And the problem here is that you don't have soil development. Everything is in about 10 centimeters. Everything is scrunched together. It's kind of like a desert pavement where everything is compressed into a very small area. So, yeah, there are certainly possibilities for people other than Earhart having left at least some of the artifacts that we found.
So you conducted some interviews with, the former colonists. They have these memories of doing things like camping. Do they remember other evidence that, I think at some point in your report, it mentions a door, an aircraft door. Were there other sort of oral histories that give clues or pieces of evidence that aren't as easily captured in the archaeological record?
There are consistent stories of bones being found in two locations. On the Northwest Reef, adjacent to the Northwest Reef on the island, and on the southeast end of the island. But they're all very vague. We remember our parents and grandparents talking about finding these bones. Very general stories. We have some stories that were recorded earlier that also indicate the discovery of bones on both ends of the island. We think that the bones on the northwest end were probably those of the Norwich City castaways, five of whom we have records were buried near the shipwreck. Now, it's also possible that one of the burials on the northwest reef could be Noonan, could be Earhart, but the northwest end of the island gets very complicated because it was all settled, allocated. The land was allocated to families. The families moved in. Members of the families died. They got buried. So there are graves up there. We know there are colonial era graves up there. So the northwest end is kind of a mess. Southeast end really didn't get occupied. It was used as this sort of place to catch turtles and birds, but that was about the size of it. It was cleared, it was planted to coconuts, but it was not occupied by a family or anything like that. Anyway, yeah, we have those kind of stories, but they are pretty general and vague.
Okay. Wow, that sounds that's such a complicated picture going on there, and then you have the sea washing everything else away when they stayed near the shore.
Yes. The sea is rapidly washing Nicomoro away, just like it's washing the entire Republic of Kiribati away. These are atolls, and global climate change and sea level rise is it's doing the place in.
April, wasn't Kiribati one of the places talked about in that movie, The Anthropologist, where we interviewed the producers and the anthropologist that was on the show?
Yeah, it is. So if you go back to episode two, we actually did an interview and they talked a lot about Kiribati and Kiribati and just sort of the impacts of global warming and global climate change on these islands. And that must be really interesting thinking about in terms of site preservation. Are you guys kind of prioritizing different areas of the island to look at more intensively, knowing that these areas might be gone in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, if I had my druthers and didn't have to pursue Amelia Earhart and had a whole bunch of money and a whole bunch of people and a whole bunch of time, I would go and really look at the colonial village because it is washing away and it's a very interesting site. We have a lot of historical information on it, and yet it was occupied for a very brief moment in time. So it's a well-preserved, short-term village where I think one could do some very interesting settlement archaeology and so on, but nobody's going to fund that. and frankly, you know, the people in Kiribati have more important things to worry about than archaeological sites. They need to keep themselves above water if they possibly can. So, we're focusing on finding Earhart because that's what people are interested in. That's what people will put the money into that is required to get out there and do archaeological work. Now, along the way, we record a lot of other stuff. Like this year, we found what appears to be a prehistoric site that we had missed all these years up on the northeast end of the island. And that happens all the time.
Nice. So back to some of the stuff that you guys found on this latest expedition in the report that you sent. You mentioned a shoe that you have that still needs analysis. Can you tell me a little bit about that shoe, like where it was found and what your guys' preliminary thoughts are on it?
Well, okay. I should go back and say that in 1991, on another part of the island, Tiger found the remains of a man's shoe and a woman's shoe. The woman's shoe was fairly complete, though in very small fragments. It was apparently from the 1930s. It was apparently a little bit too big to be Earhart's. And of course, this is an island where you don't have a lot of people wearing shoes. Even today, people just don't wear shoes, or if they do wear shoes, they wear flip-flops. The shoe was unusual, and it was away from the village. It was an odd location, and we still don't know exactly what to do with that shoe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this year we found a shoe It is apparently a woman's shoe. It is apparently, it's the kind of shoe that was being worn in the 1930s, 1940s. It's in the colonial village. And we're having arguments about, you know, where it could have come from. A lot of people would like to think that it was washed in, that it washed out of the airplane and washed into the village. I think that's nuts. I think that it was probably a kindly contribution from some charitable organization in Sydney or Melbourne or someplace to the poor people of the Phoenix Islands. They don't have shoes. Let's send them these shoes. Which the people of Phoenix Islands didn't know. Well, they mostly don't wear shoes. So I think it got tossed in the village, and that's what we found. But we got to check it. We got to see if it's got DNA in it, and if so, whose DNA? So it's in my freezer waiting for a lab. I should say that we're working on this, and among others, we're working with the Archaeological Legacy Institute in Eugene, Oregon, which runs the Archaeology Channel. And they are, Rick Pettigrew there is very, very interested in the shoe, very interested in finding out more about it. And he's looking into getting a lab that will analyze it before I turn it over to the conservation facility to be conserved. So,
okay.
Anyway, that we don't really know much about the shoe, except it's in my freezer and it keeps kicking the door saying, let me out, let me out. But I don't.
Nice. You know, when you said the shoe was slightly too big, that first one to be like Amelia Earhart's size, I seem to remember, and I'm trying to pick my brain to figure out where I heard this, but something about early aircraft, especially ones that were flying that were not necessarily designed to fly the way that they were flying, you know, with that kind of, you know, sometimes those altitudes and in those environments, that they could be a little cold, and that sometimes people would wear bigger shoes because they had like 2-3 pairs of socks on to keep their feet from freezing up while they're on the pedals, like on the rudder pedals. But I don't know, that might be just something in my brain. I'm not sure where that even came from.
No, that's true. That happened. And another thing we know is that Earhart had problems with swelling feet, as probably anybody would, flying for many, many hours in an airplane. Her feet swelled up. So did she have a larger pair of shoes aboard? Well, we can speculate that she did. We can come up with logical reasons why she would. We don't have tangible evidence that she did.
Right. Okay, well, let's take our final break, and then we'll come back and wrap up this discussion and see what you guys are going to do next time you come out. We'll be back in a minute.
All these things we make no apology are the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs.
Did aliens build Stonehenge? Did the Easter Island statues walk? Did the Vikings colonize Midwest America? What does mainstream archaeology have to say about all of this? Listen to the Archaeological Fantasies podcast and learn about popular archaeological mysteries. Hoax or fact? Learn to tell the difference with Dr. Kenneth Fader and co-host Sarah of the Archie Fantasies blog. Check out the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Archie Fantasies and get ready to think critically. Let's get back to the show.
Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
All right, we're back. So, Tom, let's talk about, we've talked about, you know, generally what you guys have done and what you found and some of the research. What, when you guys go back out again, you probably had goals. You probably have a whole list of goals and you're just kind of chipping away at them year to year. But did you come up with anything new, any new directions you might want to go? Some things you added to the list of goals and objections that came out of this most recent expedition?
Well, okay. First off, the dogs alerted on exactly the site where our evidence indicated that the bones were found in 1940. And they alerted nowhere else in that vicinity. We took them around to every tree and so on, and they didn't alert anyplace else. They alerted at this one location under this one tree where we are pretty sure the bones were found in 1940. So this tended to verify our conclusion that that is where the bones were found. They also alerted in this hole in the ground that we found when we first went to the site in 1996. And we think that hole is where the cranium was buried. We know that the cranium was buried after it was first found in 1940, and then it was excavated and sent to Fiji. We think that hole is where the cranium was buried. The dogs alerted in and around that hole. So that pretty well confirms our assumptions about where the bone, where the body decomposed and where the cranium was for a time. Hmm. So we then dug the bejeebers out of the area under the tree, the big wren tree, and in the hole. And the stuff we found there is undergoing analysis as we speak. It's at the National Geographic. That research was sponsored by the National Geographic Society. They have it. They're working with other institutions to analyze it. We also took soil from the dog alert locations, because one of the sort of hottest topics in ancient DNA studies is DNA from soil. And they've found, as you probably know, in Europe, in caves in Europe, they've been able to extract Neanderthal DNA from soils. More relevant to us, down at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, there have been a number of studies of several years old to 20 to 30 year old DNA on the locations where bodies have decomposed. So we collected a bunch of soil samples, and they are going out for analysis to see if DNA can be extracted from them. The results of those studies will give us some direction for the next time, if there is a next time. And you know, next time always depends on raising the money. It costs about $150,000 to $200,000 to get out there. The way we funded it this time and last time was we put the research together with a tour, and people paid substantial amounts of money to go on this tour. This was really pretty wonderful that people paid $10,000 to go out and sit under this tree and sort through coral rubble looking for bone fragments. But they did.
That's awesome.
And it was a remarkable enterprise, and it was inspirational. So if we can raise the money, if people are interested in taking another trip, then yeah, there will probably be another trip. Probably in a couple of years. I don't know whether I'll go or not. I'm getting pretty old for this sort of thing, and feeble and crotchety, and I don't know that I can really make another trip. But somebody probably will. What I would like to do, if that happens, is clear more of the site. In 2010, we cleared a very large area of this site that we call the Seventh Site, and we excavated it, and we found a lot of interesting stuff. We did not find, well, we may have found one human bone, but we didn't find anything definitive. This time, we cleared only a very small area because we needed to send the dogs in before the clearing was done, because clearing of the vegetation dissipates the scent. But if you clear and then let the site settle for a while, then the dogs can go in. Now, I think that one of our problems this year may have been that we didn't have a big enough area for the dogs to inspect. So they found the location under the big wren tree, but they probably did not find some of the large bones that we know were not taken away in 1940 that probably were taken away by coconut crabs and drug down into their holes. And those may be 5 meters, 10 meters, 15 meters away from the body decomposition location. So I'd like to go in, clear a large area, let it rest for a while, then send in dogs, see what they have to say, and then do some further archaeology on the site. We'll see if that happens.
I will say, just to put it out there, if you need somebody to go out there next time that is familiar with archaeology, could broadcast this and record it, and also is a licensed pilot and knows airplanes, I'll give you the name of a guy I know.
Okay, cool.
So, anyway.
Incidentally, people sometimes ask us why we don't just fly to the island, speaking of licensed pilots. It's 1,000 miles from Fiji. It's 600 and something miles from Samoa.
Yeah. So, okay. Going back to the island real quick, you mentioned that you don't, you can't go back there every year because of the cost, of course. So it might be a couple of years before you go back again. Is the island or anybody associated with, Kiribati or something like that, concerned with, preserving that area for future investigations? Is anybody doing that there? Or can you guys ensure that, no development or anything like that is going to happen on that area while you guys are gone? Is anybody looking at that from a local standpoint?
Well, we can be confident there isn't going to be any development. This is the island is part of the Phoenix Islands protected area, which is an internationally designated, it's a World Heritage Site. It is not going to be developed. Plus, of course, it's going underwater. So that's not a problem. Now, you can't really control access. Theoretically, you can't access the site without a permit from the government of Kiribati. And anybody who proposes to do archaeology or recover anything from the island, we have an agreement between Tiger and the government of Kiribati that basically Tiger gets to vet anybody's plans to do any work there. So theoretically, the area is protected. Now, there's a big difference between theory and practice because, there's no enforcement, no way to enforce the prohibitions on visiting the island. But on the other hand, it's a long way from anything, a long way from anywhere. And it's a difficult place to access and a difficult place to work. So it's, we've not had any serious difficulty with people going in and ripping stuff off. And there is no development problem. Certainly it's possible that somebody could go in, and we certainly hope they won't. It would be illegal, and the government of Kiribati would do everything it could to prosecute them. But, could somebody get in and rip something off? Yeah, probably.
Yeah. But they got to get there over 1,000 miles of water, or 700. So, okay. Well, let's talk ever so briefly, because we have to bring it up, about the History Channel show that came out, what was it, like a month ago, right about the time you guys, I think, were either getting back or finishing up your expedition. The History Channel, it was called Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence. And I'm pretty sure it was like the photograph the whole entire show was based on was debunked by a Japanese researcher like 30 minutes after the show aired or something like that. I mean, it was really fast. But what was your guys' response to that sort of thing? Because that personally for me, just to give my opinion real quick, this is why we do the Archaeology Podcast Network, to try to put some other information out there. But of course, we don't have the reach that the History Channel does. So something like that goes out. You guys have been doing expeditions, real science, looking at evidence, not making wild conclusions, based on what you find, but making your conclusions based on evidence and rational decisions. Basically, what was the response to the History Channel show, Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence? I was talking about how a lot of people probably heard about that because it's the History Channel. But things like Tigar, who are doing actual real scientific research, don't really get out there in the public as well as they should, because it's not sensationalist. It's science. So what was Tigar's response and your response to hearing about that show?
Well, let me say first that there are basically three major hypotheses about what happened to Earhart. One of them is the crashed and sank hypothesis, that she simply ran out of gas and went into the drink. And that's one hypothesis, and a lot of people have gone out and dumped a lot of money into the Pacific looking for her airplane on the bottom of the ocean. So one hypothesis is crashed and sank. Another hypothesis is Japanese capture, that she was captured by the Japanese, maybe executed by the Japanese. It has a lot of variants. But the sort of best variant on the Japanese capture hypothesis is that she wound up in the Marshall Islands, was captured there, was taken to Saipan, and wound up dying or being executed there. The History Channel show was built around the one variant on the Japanese capture hypothesis. I don't think the show was all that terrible. Now, I am sort of a minority in my group in that I can see some merit in the History Channel show. And it was not built entirely around that photograph, but it was built rather largely around the photograph. And let me just tell you a funny story. About our second day on Nikumaroro, I get a knock on the door. And the National Geographic archaeologist had received a text message on his little Garmin machine from headquarters saying, History Channel has a photograph of Earhart in the Marshall Islands. What's your response? And I said, well, maybe they have a mugshot of her with Japanese characters saying Amelia Earhart. That would be very interesting. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they have the photograph that we saw several years ago of a woman sitting on a dock, a European woman sitting on a dock, back to the camera, facing out into the water, a man standing nearby, and they say this is Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, in which case it's sheer speculation. And so it turned out, of course, that that was what they had. The fuzzy black and white image of a woman on a dock looking out, and so on. Now, we actually looked at that photograph. That photograph made the news probably 7 or 8 years ago. Tiger did an analysis of it. And, you know, it's a woman on the dock, a man on a dock standing nearby. And people say, well, this is the Marshall Islands. This is a European woman. It had to be Amelia Earhart. And that's just nonsense. The Marshall Islands had been a German colony from 1896 or thereabouts until 1917, when it went over to the Japanese after World War I. Hmm. Jalowit, the island where the photograph was taken, was the German headquarters. There were, even in the Japanese period, there were still lots of German missionaries, traders, medical personnel, and so on. So, yeah, there was a European woman sitting on the dock. Was it Amelia Earhart? Well, particularly when it turned out that the photograph was from 1935, no, probably not. But even without that dating, the photograph doesn't prove anything. It's a European woman on a dock and looking out over the ocean. And those who like the photograph say, well, but the ship across the bay, has an airplane that it's towing. Well, you know, there's something sort of light-colored and sort of kind of vaguely airplane-ish behind the ship. Is it an airplane? Well, maybe. Maybe it's a Klingon warbird. I don't know. I don't think you can tell from the from the photograph, and it certainly isn't proof of anything. Now, does that mean Earhart was not captured by the Japanese? No. Maybe she was. I just don't think the evidence is very good for it. What the Japanese capture people basically hang their hat on is anecdotal evidence. They say, look, all these people say they saw Earhart. And there's been an awful lot of research lately into the problems with anecdotal evidence, even with very good firsthand eyewitness accounts. And the psychological literature is full of studies of how unreliable eyewitness testimony really is. And so to say, oh, well, because these 300 people said they saw Earhart in the Marshall Islands, she must have been there. Not necessarily so.
Okay. Well, we are just about out of time, but I will say if that were a Klingon warbird, that'd be an even bigger story, I think.
That's true.
So, well, Tom, real quick, is there anything that you wanted to say about this expedition or about what you guys did out there that we didn't get a chance to ask you?
Well, just that we had fantastic cooperation from the government of Kiribati, and that it was a really interesting project for all of us. And it was a cooperative venture by Tiger, National Geographic, Betchard Expeditions, which ran the whole thing, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, the Archaeological Legacy Institute. It was a cooperative venture, and it worked out very, very well. And I hope we can do another one, and I hope that it produces some useful data. And that's about the size of it.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Tom. Check out some of the links in the show notes. We'll have a link to Tigar and the other podcast that Tom was on and anything else we can find. So,
yeah, by all means, please do link to the Tigar website. There's all the information you could ever want about what we're doing on that website. And that's also where you can join Tigar and support the enterprise.
Outstanding. Okay. So check that out. And again, thanks, Tom. And we'll have you, maybe we'll have you on again when you get that shoe analyzed out of your freezer.
Oh, yeah. Only archaeologists keep shoes in their freezer.
That's a fact. I have shoes and roots in my freezer right now.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you. And we'll see everybody next time.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle.
And edited by Richie Cruz.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.